Climate change is already hitting home.
But communities across the U.S. are finding ways to adapt and build resilience to its impacts. This is Higher Ground. I'm J.D. Allen.
And I'm Sabrina Garone. This hour, we're telling stories of people engaged in community science.
In the face of rising anxiety about the climate, they're taking control to understand changes to their environment. So, from air pollution monitoring to preparing for extreme weather,
or just getting dirty outdoors,
these communities are able to keep cool heads in the face of global warming.
Exploring these solutions might give their home the best chance at survival and help save vulnerable places
where millions of people call home.
Coming up next, we get to Higher Ground.
Distributed by APM, American Public Media.
WSHU, the station you know, trust, and count on, is more relevant than ever. I'm WSHU and American Homefront Project reporter Desiree DiOrio. Your support has enabled us to deliver what you need at a moment's notice, wherever you happen to be. We can tell stories that really matter, connecting facts and revealing the truths you need. Thank you for listening and supporting WSHU Public Radio. We're stronger together.
Long Island Sound is an estuary that supports an abundance of wildlife and about 4 million residents between Connecticut and Long Island.
From pristine beach landscapes to bustling cities, the region is a unique part of the country.
But it's facing the same climate challenges that are being felt all across the U.S.
Climate change is really going to change the future of Long Island, and we have to keep that in mind, and not just keep it in mind, but get ready.
Our infrastructure needs to totally change because our infrastructure is not sustainable as it is.
There's just a greater density of people here. There's a lot more impervious cover. We have rivers coming in.
Over the years, the marshlands have eroded, so now many of the bay houses that you see, now they are on the shoreline.
The environmental benefits from natural systems being intact and functioning, you know, as nature designed is so important for our quality of life.
You know what happens? It's in your veins. The salt runs through your veins. Once you're addicted to the salt life, you can't get away from it. You could never take me away from this environment.
We've traveled all around this coastline as we've produced two seasons of the podcast Higher Ground, learning the stories of people who are adapting to the changing climate in their neighborhoods.
And we've been struck by how everyday people are finding and implementing their own solutions using community science.
Community science is a great uniter in general. It's a way for people from all sorts of backgrounds who might not be formally engaged in science. It's a way for them to get together. It's a way for them to make their voices heard.
Michelle Lewis is director of community science at the Discovery Science Center and Planetarium in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
That's the state's largest city, sitting right on Long Island Sound.
It's her job to draw people into science as a way of looking at their world.
It's much easier for you to care about something that is closer to home than something big and out there. So saying stuff like, oh, climate change is affecting the whole country and it's affecting it in this, this, and this ways, as opposed to saying like, hey, you might have noticed when it rains now, it rains a lot more often and it's flooding more often in our area. That's something easier for people to connect with. Being a scientist is not a job. It's asking questions.
Eighth graders in Michelle's after-school program recently investigated the health of local waterways, tree canopy cover, and air quality, just some of the climate challenges the kids observed in Bridgeport and other areas around the state.
A lot of them were like, well, I'm just a kid. Like, should I be focused? Should this be something that I should be worrying about? How can we get them to see that what they care about is affected by this as well? People feeling like they're alone, like it's just them against the world, is unfortunate, but it does happen. But things where you get together to work together to have something to say, we did that. That's a really big takeaway from doing community science.
It can be hard to think about what climate change means to you, the individual, on a local level, especially when the narrative tends to feel very
doom and gloom.
Yeah, exactly. Community science can be a way to move past those dreadful feelings.
Part of doing community science is what are the concerns What is the history? What is the background of the people you want to reach? And then trying to meet them there and then kind of give them a chance to take charge in some way.
Come with us this hour as we meet immigrant farm workers weathering extreme conditions on Long Island's North Fork.
Architecture students who are planning for resilient buildings in an old post-industrial city.
And elementary school kids who are learning to grow their own food.
So make sure you have your buddy. Make sure you have a shovel. And we're all going to stay together. Ready? Let's go.
That's coming up this hour on Higher Ground.
But first, JD, I'm going to take you to New Haven. It's another one of Connecticut's coastal cities where residents are putting the idea of community science to work as they face a very specific local air quality issue. Yep, that's a plane flying over neighboring East Haven. I went to see how the expansion of Tweed New Haven Airport, which is right along the Sound's tidal marshes, is causing a big controversy.
So what's the plan?
Well, it includes a new terminal and expanded runway, which the neighborhood points out would be built in a floodplain. And they're also concerned, like really concerned, about increased air pollution.
We couldn't be outside. We couldn't garden anymore because I was so close to the airport and the fumes were so overwhelming and we would get dizzy and have to run inside.
That's Gabriella Campos, who used to live right near Tweed.
By the photos, it looks like a modest single-family home with a fence and a garden.
Mm-hmm. I went to meet with her and my colleague Davis Donovan, who's actually been doing a lot of reporting on this issue.
Now, you mentioned that the planes obviously are very loud, obviously are a distraction, and that there was some possible soot or contamination that she found on a chair. Does it affect the food at all?
It was really sad because we had built that garden over many years. It was beautiful, but I was also concerned about what, you know, chemicals were falling on the food that I was trying to grow organically.
You can feel everything rumbling. You really can't hear yourself talk or think. Usually we have to pause conversations when this happens. And you can feel the rumble under your feet. It isn't just the sound, it's the vibration. Everything shakes. It shakes your spine, it shakes your skull, it shakes you from the inside.
An environmental assessment done by the Federal Aviation Administration in March of 2023 predicted the emission levels from the airport's expansion wouldn't have much of an impact on local air quality through 2031.
That's just 7 years away.
Right. Advocates like Gabriella say that's not nearly enough time to determine long-term impacts.
One of the things that NEPA says that is supposed to be considered if there are farms.
NEPA, that's the National Environmental Policy Act, providing the consulting services for the expansion project.
You know, the federal aviation, I don't think, is considering is that there are so many small urban type farms where people are growing food to supplement their food intake. I mean, the food has increased in price just in 1 year, almost doubled. And so, you know, having access to some fresh produce is pretty important to people. Yeah.
So
we're getting a plane flying overhead right now, which is a smaller plane and not
an eagle.
Oh, bald eagle.
Bald eagle. Yeah, beautiful. Oh, I haven't seen one all year. That was so cool. But right. And so we're also in a migratory path. And, you know, it's a really important migratory path considering that we're between New York and Boston and there's so much construction in this area. There's not a lot of green spaces. And this is a major thoroughfare. And the fact that there's these huge planes displacing, it's concerning. It's concerning for the food. I know
we were down by the beach before. So to get a better idea of what locals are dealing with, Gabriella took us to a friend's house just down the road. Standing on Patrick Rowland's rooftop deck, a small private plane flew right overhead. So not one of the larger commercial planes, but even still, it was actually pretty scary.
They were surprised that everybody goes food.
That's nothing. That's what should be here. It should be those.
Right, but even that's
surprising. All that. Yeah, but and those are actually what used the fuel that has the lead poisoning in Santa Clara. In my research, I found there's an airport, Santa Clara, California, is a small municipal airport, and it's not far from San Jose and San Francisco, so it's much like us, and it's owned by the county, and the county voted to close the airport instead of continuing to take federal subsidies because they did a lead study, And within 5 miles of the airport, the kids were, and actually adults too, but more importantly kids, because lead poisoning hurts kids more. But the lead poisoning was higher than Flint, Michigan.
New Haven's mayor, Justin Elliker, who's backing the airport expansion, even conceded that more air traffic is not good for climate change.
We also don't look at Tweed as if it's an island, as if it's the only thing going on in the city of New Haven and the only areas where we can address our climate change issues.
Didn't the mayor say that the city plans to place air quality detectors around Tweed to see how different neighborhoods are being impacted?
Yes, but it turns out the community is actually way ahead of him. A very similar project is already underway that brings together local residents and university researchers.
Sounds like community science to me.
I think it's important that each community has its own voice and has its own way of sharing how they are being impacted, because they know best what's happening in their little microclimate.
With the help of researchers at Tufts University, residents have placed sensors the size of mini fridges in at least a dozen areas around the airport that measure air pollution as a plane takes off.
What they found was that there was very little air pollution around here except for when a plane took off or landed. And so those numbers haven't been made public yet, but that is consistent with what we experience living here. Because if you drive around East Haven and you drive around the area, I mean, you can see where we are here. There is a considerable amount of nature, despite being in an urban setting, and people do, you know, try to plant trees and try to keep nature, some sort of nature preserves.
Gabriella hopes New Haven officials will learn the lessons of this community science effort.
The city thinks, oh, we'll do this expansion, we'll push it off to East Haven, we're just going to dump all the problems in East Haven, and New Haven people will be fine. But there's no magical wall between East Haven and New Haven. We're neighbors, we share the same air, we share the same water, we're still in the same soup of pollution.
So what happened in the meantime to Gabriella and her family?
Well, in the end, the air pollution became such a concern for her that she actually sold her house near the airport and moved to a different part of the city.
The water's crystalline, the sun is shining. It's just standing here for a minute. It's like peace, minus the airplanes.
Both New Haven and Bridgeport are cities that sit on Long Island Sound, so rising tides are also presenting a problem.
More frequent flooding and intense storms are making it difficult to catalog and analyze data to better prepare for the future. But one new project is harnessing the power of community science to monitor this coastline and many others around the country.
The people who are on the ground who are dealing with emergency preparedness didn't always have the latest information. And so I was able to pull the app up right in real time and show the fire department, you know, here's what we're expecting. We can see visually what it looks like now, and here's what the current and then future tide phases will look like.
More on that just ahead on Higher Ground from WSHU Public Radio, distributed by APM, American Public Media.
Davis Donovan. For years, I've traveled all over the Northeast, unpacking strange stories and unusual histories for my show, Off the Path. This year, I set sail to learn about the region's rich maritime history, from submarines to lighthouses to Moby Dick, or more specifically, people obsessed with Moby Dick.
How long have you had this copy of Moby Dick? It looks like it's been around a little bit.
I got this in 1986.
What brought you to Moby Dick? I mean, do you remember how you fell in love with the book?
Oh, yeah, I distinctly remember. It was a girl.
Maritime history has no shortage of colorful characters, and that includes pirates. So we're calling this season Off the Plank. You'll hear about a mutiny on a pirate ship.
Their bodies are chucked into the water, and the other mutineers decide to elect William Fly as their captain. They sew themselves a Jolly Roger and rename their ship the Fame's Revenge.
I visit a museum with a haul of real pirate treasure, salvaged from a 1700s shipwreck.
These are coins, silver coins from the shipwreck, and we do find them just as you see. Maybe not quite with so much luster, but they are on the seafloor, buried in the sand.
And there's a bonus with each episode. We'll have a song to go with each story.
Oh, we'll rant and we'll roar like true Yankee weathermen. We'll rant and we'll roar on deck and below.
It's Off the Plank, dropping anchor on May 10th from WSHU Public Radio.
And straight up the channel to New Bedford we'll go.
I'm J.D. Allen. Welcome back to Higher Ground from WSHU Public Radio, distributed by APM, American Public Media.
And I'm Sabrina Garone. This hour, we're telling you the stories of communities engaged in science as they face the threat of climate change.
That includes harnessing the power of crowdsourcing to record real-time data about extreme weather. In the face of more frequent flooding, it's a better way to prepare for the future. As Molly Ingram reports, there's an app for that.
A decade ago, flooding from Superstorm Sandy caused massive damage along the East Coast and forced coastal communities to spend millions of dollars on infrastructure upgrades. But when it comes to planning for the future, municipalities do not always know where roads and homes need to be reinforced for coming storms. That's where the app MyCoast comes in. It allows users to track and report environmental issues in their area.
So a big storm event would happen. People would go out afterwards or sometimes during to record, okay, this is what's happening.
That's Wesley Shaw. He developed MyCoast with his business partner, Chris Ray, in response to coastal flooding in Massachusetts.
We're seeing erosion. We're seeing houses falling down. We're seeing porches being ripped off or whatever else like that. That would go, depending on the severity of the storm, either back to the Office of Coastal Management or to the Emergency Operations Center, be processed, and that would help allocate resources after a storm.
The MyCoast app is already used in at least 7 states and the Virgin Islands, and not just for flooding. Washington tracks creosote-treated wood, and South Carolina tracks abandoned boats. Now, Cornell researchers Jessica Cuonan and Kathleen Fallon say they believe it could be the key to helping New York plan ahead for coastal events.
We're seeing a lot of flooded parking lots and flooded streets, lots of homes in the background, you know, marina parking lots, a lot of waterfront parks.
Cuonan says the goal of launching MyCoast in New York is to keep the public, as well as legislators, aware of the impacts of climate change on the region.
The more reports we get and the more we can encourage our decision makers at the county and municipal level, you know, emergency managers, if they're using it in a risk communication, we would consider that a success.
More than 13,000 people have registered for the app since it launched in July of 2022. Emily Vale uses the app in Kingston, which borders the Hudson River. She says tracking the flooding in her community makes her feel like she's contributing to finding a solution.
It's not just me going out and documenting some pictures and wondering what I should do with them. It's being compiled. It's being used in a way that is accessible to decision makers so that they can see, you know, municipal staff are really hardworking. They have so much on their plate and they can't just be everywhere at once. And so if community members can help document some of these conditions.
Vail used the app during a flooding event that turned out to be the highest storm surge since Superstorm Sandy. She was able to pass information from the app onto first responders on the scene of the floods.
The people who are on the ground who are dealing with emergency preparedness didn't always have the latest information. And so I was able to pull the app up right in real time and show the fire department, you know, here's what we're expecting. We can see visually what it looks like now, and here's what the current and then future tide phases will look like.
Cuonan says the information compiled during that storm surge event was passed on to the National Weather Service.
They were really interested in the data from that December 23rd event. And I think it's helping them understand what waterfronts are vulnerable to storm surge.
Since launching the app, 28,000 reports from around the country have been filed. In a recent survey, users were asked why they contribute photos. The number one response was concern about floods and storm impacts in their community. The third most popular response was that they wanted to contribute to a solution.
That was Molly Ingram reporting. All over the country, a new generation of architecture students is facing the reality that climate change will radically alter how buildings are conceived.
They're the ones who will have to find solutions, but first, they'll have to learn how. Reporter Eve Zukoff went to visit one unique building in New Bedford, Massachusetts, that offers a perfect test case.
Hi, I'm Jai.
I'm Risa.
I'm Trey.
And we're Team Lumina.
The three architecture students from Howard University in Washington, D.C. are trying to film a 90-second video explaining how they could reimagine the Hillman Street Firehouse in the heart of this former manufacturing city on the coast of Massachusetts.
Okay, let me try this one more time.
Okay.
Sophomore Jai Edward Blyden delivers his lines first.
Built in 1892, the Hillman Firehouse is a representation of New Bedford's best and bravest men who saved countless lives and fought ferocious fires to keep the town safe and secure.
The red brick building, a Romanesque revival, has boarded up windows, a crumbling facade, and a perimeter fence. It's been vacant for almost 30 years. A familiar sight in this legacy industrial city, which is also home to a lot of old mill buildings looking for a new purpose. But Blyden and a dozen of his classmates see hints of the firehouse's former glory. They point up at floral motifs in the brick, and a small tower on the back corner that makes the building look like a castle.
It has a lot of charm.
The students made the trek from Washington to Massachusetts' south coast as part of a program called the Envision Resilience Challenge, which brings together city planners, community members, and college students in climate-vulnerable areas. They're here to learn what it would take to restore the building's exterior, reusing everything they can, and then redesign its interior with modern, affordable apartments. And as church bells chime across the street, senior Raisa Magampwe says a major part of the project is learning how to design the building so that it actually creates more energy than it uses.
Our design goals are to regenerate, advocate, and provide a new opportunity for the Hillman Street Firehouse.
Across the country, hundreds of thousands of homes are demolished every year. They're replaced by something bigger and ideally better. The result? The building and construction sector is responsible for about 40% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. But this new generation of architects is learning what it would take to knock that number down by resuscitating older structures with a minimal carbon footprint.
We're working with three big goals. What will create the equity which we want? What will create the energy efficiency? What will create regeneration?
That's Nia Malou, assistant professor at Howard University's College of Engineering and Architecture. She says her students are learning how to waste as little as possible in this design challenge, because every material that went into this building 130 years ago costs carbon. Consider, she says, what it took to manufacture, transport, and assemble just one brick.
Literally, it's ridiculous if you start adding the carbon. But if I can reuse that brick for another 100 years, then it is so worth it.
New Bedford itself stands as an emblem of vulnerability to climate change. A recent report found sea levels around the South Coast city are projected to rise more than 2 feet in 25 years. The city will be left particularly vulnerable if or when its hurricane barrier is overcome. The massive seawall protects against flooding in the port of New Bedford, which is the most prosperous seafood port in the country. It's the direct result of a highly valued scallop fishery. Each year, it supports 39,000 jobs and generates about $1.8 billion in total personal wages. If the port can't operate, those jobs and wages disappear.
For a port city like New Bedford, having these intense storms can be just paralyzing for our city and our industry, frankly, that relies on our port.
That's Catherine Duff, an architect who's working with a historic preservation group on a $3.7 million project to actually restore the firehouse. She's advising the students and steering them towards designs that can withstand a climate crisis. Because of sea level rise, the city is preparing for more flooding and storms that force officials to close the gates of the hurricane barrier. In 2019, the Army Corps of Engineers closed the barrier 26 times. In just 25 years, they may have to close the barrier at every high tide. That means 1 to 2 times a day. So in designing surrounding homes and businesses,
there's a lot of pressure for resiliency.
As designs continue to take shape for the exterior of the Hillman Street Firehouse, the students must also consider the interior. They're working out how to divide the building into as many as 9 apartments with 1 or 2 bedrooms each.
It's really packed. Bob knows it's a very dense plan.
They talk about how, in the next phase of the building's life, they could replace a gas heating system with solar panels and electric heat pumps. A recent report showed that making the switch can reduce a home's carbon footprint by as much as 50%. Then they could also make sure the building has a tighter envelope, so less of that heat leaks out. But looking around at the nearby diner, flower shop, and homes, senior Journey O'Neill says he doesn't want to stray too far from the original conception of the neighborhood.
We want to preserve as much as possible in our designs. I feel like it really is a structure that stands out in a community of houses that are very unique.
Ultimately, though, O'Neill and the others see beyond the raw materials.
I really want our structure to be a high standard in terms of bringing people together in housing that people can feel very comfortable and their kids can grow up in and they can be established and be successful.
To do that, Jai Edward Blyden says he's studying the street closely.
We have the Hillman Firehouse, but what's down the street? You know, are there any local or affordable groceries? You know, is there a recreation center? So I've kind of gotten into a bit more than just the building itself, but everything that surrounds it, the bigger picture.
That bigger picture reveals that New Bedford is home to large environmental justice communities, where residents face increased environmental risks because of language barriers, race, or income. One example, in the 19th and early 20th centuries, the city enjoyed massive economic prosperity, thanks in large part to the whaling industry and textile mills. But in the 1940s through the 70s, manufacturers dumped toxic chemicals from factories into the harbor. And it took residents, many of them from low-income and immigrant groups, decades of fighting to get a fair and effective cleanup. Professor Nia Malou is teaching her students if they can restore an important old building like the Hillman Street Firehouse, they can create a glimmer of hope.
So much can be done if it revived. And when you revive something, like when you layer future on history, it becomes present, and it's the most beautiful thing.
The students, who've met repeatedly with local leaders to guide their process, have until April to finalize their design concept. At that point, they hope to return to New Bedford to share their vision of transforming a 19th century firehouse into a 21st century model of sustainability.
Eve Zukoff is with us to talk more about Envision Resilience, the project that's sponsoring the upgrade of New Bedford's Hillman Firehouse.
Eve, as you mentioned, Hillman isn't the only building getting this intensive treatment. Give us a sense of the bigger project.
Sure. So this story centers on Howard University, but it's not the only team through Envision Resilience. There are teams from Northeastern University, Rhode Island School of Design, the University of Florida, UMass Amherst, and the University of Virginia. And each group is looking at a different community or focus area along Massachusetts' south coast. Like, we talked a lot about the Port of New Bedford in this story. And one team is developing modifications to the hurricane barrier and sharing their findings.
Mm-hmm. And where else in the country has Envision Resilience been working?
So this program is in its third year. The first years, student groups worked in the Narragansett area in Rhode Island and on Nantucket, the island off the coast of Cape Cod. Now, I know so many people have this impression that kind of both of these places are summer playgrounds, places for rich people who have more than enough money to solve their own problems. But first of all, there's also very real working class communities in these places. There are nurses and firefighters and postal workers and journalists, for that matter. And second of all, climate change just doesn't discriminate. The fact is, from now through 2070, on Nantucket, 20% of roads and 12% of buildings are at risk from coastal flooding and erosion. And the community still needs to figure out what to do. So they brought in Envision Resilience and assigned community leaders to help the students get to the heart of the next great ideas. And I can now share, the next Envision Resilience Challenge will be in Portland, Maine.
Oh, that's so cool. Now, outside Envision Resilience, this building is actually being restored. As Catherine Duff said, what can you tell us about that?
Yes, yeah, so there's this organization called the Waterfront Historic Area League, or WHALE, and it really focuses on restoring historic buildings in New Bedford, this historic city in Massachusetts. They've been looking at trying to redevelop the property as affordable housing for a few years now. There are design plans, but there's kind of more funding needed for this adaptive reuse project, so there's still more to come there. But they're really hopeful that in 2024, this building will begin to transform.
So if we could just take a step back here for a moment, there's all these efforts to restore this building, but how does that actually help create more environmental justice?
Well, when you look for definitions of environmental justice, there's kind of a consistent one that comes up, and I'll paraphrase it here. Environmental justice affirms the need to clean up and rebuild our cities in balance with nature, honoring the cultural integrity of all our communities, and provided fair access for all to the full range of resources. So in rebuilding a place like New Bedford, where, as we said, there are so many buildings, former mill buildings, that are just in need of new life, we have to be considering in these places what takes into consideration the fact that we need development, but we also need to consider climate change. We also need to consider the fabric of individual communities. We need to make sure that development doesn't come with gentrification, squeezing out people who call it home. Development doesn't come with polluted streets, polluted air. Environmental justice, though, has to start with individual projects. Like so many things, start local, go global. And a building like this, I think what the students are hoping from Howard is that, and they said this to me a few times, they said, we hope this is kind of a gem of the community, that this reignites this this one street. And then from there, maybe it ignites a project on the street over, and from there, and from there, and from there. You know, after this story aired locally, we got this email from someone who heard it. And it's this person who used to live near New Bedford. They lived, this person lived with his late wife just a block away. And he said, I've walked past that firehouse countless times, admiring its features. And we often speculated about how the building might be saved and repurposed. I'm so glad the firehouse has drawn the attention of young designers and housing advocates. And it was people like this one man who wrote me this email who really have advised the students, even while we were just standing out there and they were kind of taking everything in. People were walking by, neighbors were walking by, coming out of their cars, coming out of their houses, just to chat for a few minutes with two or three students here or there. And that's, you know, emblematic of how the whole process has actually run. The students met for the whole first semester with local leaders to make sure, are we capturing something accurately here? So the hope is a building like this starts somewhere, because gosh, we need to start somewhere to create more environmental justice.
Yeah, and community involvement is a big piece of that. Thanks so much for that, Eve.
Thank you, guys.
Photos of the student architecture project in New Bedford and more are available at wshu.org/higherground podcast.
Still ahead on Higher Ground, we visit with immigrant farm workers on Long Island's North Fork who are trying to stay safe in the face of increasingly intense working conditions.
And we hear from young people experiencing extreme climate anxiety.
This is Higher Ground from WSHU Public Radio, distributed by APM, American Public Media.
Sometimes you need a little jolt of caffeine. Sometimes decaf is better. Whatever mood you're in, the music on Sunday Baroque is a satisfying brew. Pour yourself a steaming mug and take a sip of Sunday Baroque, Sundays at 7, here on WSHU.
Well,
Welcome back to Higher Ground from WSHU Public Radio, distributed by APM, American Public Media. I'm Sabrina Garone.
And I'm J.D. Allen. So far, we've talked about how climate change affects people's neighborhoods and homes. But for those who work outdoors, climate change is also affecting how they make their living. Long Island's North Fork is a rich agricultural region home to farms and vineyards.
Intense heat and extreme weather due to climate change has made agricultural labor a lot more difficult and sometimes even dangerous. Farm workers, many of whom are immigrants with limited English, are now looking for ways to be better prepared before disaster strikes. Ada Uzenlar explains.
Heat waves, hurricanes, and extreme air quality conditions are just a few hurdles that farm workers on Long Island face in their work. Even when a climate event isn't sudden, there are times when workers don't have the resources or preparation to stay healthy.
A person who's working 60 hours a week in greenhouses feels like they're in a sauna, because when it's 90 degrees outside, under that plastic, it's like 110 degrees and they have no breaks. What can a person do against that?
That's Margaret Palmquist. She organizes with a local labor union. Legislation went into effect in 2020, legalizing the right for New York farm workers to collectively negotiate for equitable housing and working conditions. New York is one of only 14 states to allow this type of union to form at all. Now, farm workers say that they want to feel prepared for their changing working environment. Former nursery farm worker Yadira Vasquez says that preparedness can foster resilience that protects health long term.
Should I stop working? No. We have to work because we have orders to fill. Workers don't see how this will affect them, not right now, but in the future. If you don't have any health, how will you provide for your family?
Gladys Carrillo directs program services at the National Center for Farmworker Health in Texas. Before that, she was a farmworker with her family in Illinois. She says a farmworker's increased awareness of their health is important to the whole family.
Being healthy allows them to be able to spend more time together, to be able to live longer, and to be able to have those memories that really are priceless when it comes down to it.
Carrillo says a farm worker's boss is immediately responsible for ensuring their health.
Employers really are pivotal in terms of having a healthy workforce.
And OSHA guidelines from the federal government require it. But Carrillo says employers don't always fulfill their duties. Vasquez shares from experience.
Por ejemplo, los dueños.
Owners want the workers to do their jobs. They are obviously not going to tell them that the weather is bad for their health.
Carrillo says when employers don't cut it, there are other organizations that can step in, from nonprofits like Rural and Migrant Ministry to houses of worship such as the North Fork Spanish Apostolate, and educators like Cornell Cooperative Extension. And now, labor unions. But some migrant and seasonal farm workers on Long Island aren't documented and can make engaging with a farm worker union a lot more complicated. Marianne Trasciotti is a labor expert at Hofstra University.
All of that is made even more intense when the workers who are considering organizing or maybe actually engaging in organizing are undocumented, right? Because they're just way more vulnerable.
Especially if there is a constant threat of retaliation from an employer. Undocumented workers still have resources. Trasciotti says people trust the information they hear through those they're close to the most.
You're actually, believe it or not, more likely to heed information that comes from a friend or a trusted source than from even an authority figure. And if you think about the vulnerability that many migrant workers find themselves in, it's no surprise that they might not trust authority figures.
Trasciotti's advice in community organizing is to identify a common leader who can communicate quickly and effectively. Identify people with reliable transportation. Learn who has the best command of English in emergencies. She says it's about coming together to form a collective.
The strength of the labor movement, historically, now, and forever, is solidarity.
Trasciotti sees the kind of resilience that farm workers are seeking as a flexible strength, one that can bend but won't break. And it's stronger together.
That was Ada Uzenlar reporting. Young people today report severe anxiety about climate change.
I'd say so. A 2022 survey of thousands of young people found that climate change has caused severe eco-anxiety in youth around the world. It's hard not to feel overwhelmed by an endless stream of negative climate news on social media.
Doom scrolling leads to poor mental health. Researchers from Yale School of Public Health has shown that collective action combats symptoms of eco-anxiety.
We've heard from youth activists across New England who have responded online by creating bite-sized content.
Like on social media.
Yeah, to tackle a range of issues around climate change.
There's a lot of anxiety about climate change. I think people need to understand there is a solution, there is a way out of this, and there was a way to live around this problem. I think social media is a big sort of ease into that, the new world that we're going to live in.
That's Asad Syed. He's a high schooler in Fairfield, Connecticut, and co-founder of Sustainable Fairfield Students. He creates educational videos to raise awareness on climate issues like the downsides of industrial farming.
It sounds like the ways we get our food is one of his key issues.
I think food sustainability is a big one for me. The main reason that it's so simple that anyone can do it, since switching out some meat or some eggs out of your diet is something that's way less expensive and also way less of a big deal than switching out your gasoline car to an electric car.
Obviously, Asad's been studying climate change and its solutions from a pretty young age.
Absolutely. He represents one of the next generation of potential leaders in the climate movement. And he's not alone. In Massachusetts, Ollie Perrault has been a climate activist for as long as she can remember.
I am 15 years old now, but when people ask me at what age I first got involved and when I started thinking about these issues, I tell them that I've been involved in this fight for my entire life, because I believe that for my generation, there was never a time when climate change wasn't a reality.
Ollie is involved in her community as a youth climate leader, as part of the conservation group Mass Audubon. Another fun fact, she grew up on her family's farm.
She must have seen a lot of the effects of climate change firsthand.
So we can go from irrigating 24/7 to fight off the drought to watching the weather for flash flood warnings pretty fast. For a while, I think that my family saw these changes as simply the daily struggle of managing risk and managing unpredictability as farmers, because that's what farming is all about. But it has become increasingly clear that climate change, that these extremes are not, they're not normal.
Interesting. So we know that industrial farming can drive climate change, while small-scale farms like Ollie's families often suffer the most.
Ollie said they're essential to communities but have the least resources to recover from disaster.
There was never a time when I wasn't worried about the future of my family's farm.
What about solutions?
Mass Audubon's youth leadership program empowers students to speak up about climate change and collaborate on everyday ways to address the effects of climate change in their own communities.
We have the micro solutions. We have that everyday easy action items that people can incorporate into their daily lives, these little changes that people can make to make their lives more sustainable.
That's things like eating locally grown food, composting organic waste, and cutting out single-use plastics.
We, as youth activists, are really encouraging and pushing for people to start thinking bigger.
It sounds like reduce, reuse, recycle just isn't enough for these youth activists.
Definitely. They want bolder action. Organizing climate justice issues is the top priority. Erica Roy is a teen from Nashua, New Hampshire. In 2022, she helped organize a rally with the group 350 New Hampshire to protest state leaders in action on climate change and demand renewable energy legislation.
At the end, when I got to see how many people were there, all the speeches that were there, and like how people talked so like passionately about the environment, it really did just give me a lot of hope.
The reality of climate change and the scale of solutions needed is clear to youth activists like Ollie Perrault in Massachusetts.
And at times, it's overwhelming.
We're really angry. We feel angry that even today there are so many people out there ignoring our calls to action.
But these young people say they won't back down from the challenge and are empowered by the actions they take with their peers.
Yes, absolutely. This frustration can definitely take a toll on our mental health. And growing up knowing that this mess has been left to our generation to clean up is painfully clear to us. But young people have always been and always will be catalysts of change.
Finally, this hour, we're turning from high school activists to an even younger age group.
Yes, these are the very youngest community scientists we've encountered. More than 20 public schools in Connecticut have developed school gardens to give children a different approach to learning.
Megan Briggs visited a magnet school in New Haven where students are learning new things about their environment just by playing in the dirt.
Stay together. This way. Listen.
At John S. Martinez Sea and Sky STEM Magnet School, a pre-kindergarten class uses trowels and buckets to transfer soil to the garden beds for the first time. They're under the guidance of Holly Brandstatter, an outdoor learning specialist from Common Ground Schoolyards program.
So make sure you have your buddy. Make sure you have a shovel. And we're all going to stay together. Ready? Let's go.
A second grade class installed the three garden beds the week before. Other classes will get the chance to cultivate the beds for planting. The students had a lot of ownership over the process.
Why don't we start by putting soil in your bucket? Work as a team.
It might be a little bit hard, so you can use your trowels and your hands.
Schoolyards program manager Robin Stewart says young kids develop a range of skills through this kind of outdoor learning. Even a task as simple as moving soil presents opportunities for growth.
This is kids engaging in real work that needs to be done. And I mean, there's also a lot of fine motor, gross motor, teamwork going on here.
Fourth grader Giovannalise Morales enjoys working with the soil.
So with the buckets, we're grabbing dirt and we're putting dirt inside the little thing so we could plant things like fruits, vegetables, and like plants.
Morales says garden beds are good for the rest of the community too.
They're very learnable and I think that they do a lot to the neighborhood because bees come and they give things to the flowers.
She's right. Green spaces do a lot to support healthy urban environments. According to a 2014 study out of Columbia University, urban agriculture, like community gardens, mitigate against the urban heat island effect. Cities like New Haven trap and absorb heat, leading to rising temperatures, increased energy costs, and heat-related illness. Community gardens help create green space for residents to enjoy, as well as manage stormwater, and they're small in scale and rarely replace food production. But Brandstatter says students are able to learn early to be conscious of their environment.
So yeah, even our preschoolers have a solid idea about, not necessarily sustainability, but just environmental stewardship. They tend to be really empathetic towards the things that we find.
Brandstatter encourages kids to count dandelions, pick weeds, and inspect the soil for squirming creatures. Excited students run back to present their findings.
Are they still moving around? Do you want to put it in the garden beds?
And sometimes tell a harrowing story of a near miss with a bee.
Ooh, well, they all don't like to sting, but sometimes they have to if they feel scared.
At John S. Martinez, social and emotional learning strategies are central to the way they teach. This means educators are trained in methods that allow all students to find different ways to succeed. Teacher Alyssa Granada Basso says foundational skills can be developed in the dirt, from identifying the alphabet with letters made of sticks to practicing math equations with rocks.
And I will tell you that kids actively seek out and ask for more time outside now because of how much they enjoy it.
Not every school has access to ample green space or the training to incorporate the outdoors into their curriculum. Common Ground seeks to bridge that gap with professional development programs. Granada Basso says she recognizes the difference made by just one school garden.
Because it levels that playing field and gives them that experiential learning that they truly deserve.
And a budding interest for urban gardening in cities across Connecticut. For kids like Morales, the school garden is just the start.
My dream garden will probably be with roses and tomatoes and probably grapes and apples.
So when you're older, you're going to plant stuff in your backyard?
I think so, yes.
That was Megan Briggs reporting.
All of the community science projects we've heard this hour are about empowering ordinary people to take action in the face of a problem that at first seems beyond the reach of individuals.
Discovery Center Director of Community Science Michelle Lewis says it's up to all of us to create what comes next in science.
Science builds on what came before.
So you take an idea or something someone else had and then you build on that and you change on that, or you look at it from a new angle. And that's also a great way, or a great reason, for more people to be involved in it. Everybody has different experiences. Everybody sees the world slightly differently than someone else. The more people who are involved, the richer the science becomes. And I feel like people just getting involved in community science is just a way to expand that.
It's permission to be curious.
It really is. We give kids that permission all the time. And I feel like as we get older, we feel like we lose that permission to be curious, because you encourage kids to ask questions all the time. And then at a certain age, you kind of like, well, I don't think I can. It's like, no, you can still ask questions. You can still be curious about the world. It doesn't have to be a career path. You can just ask a question and look for the answer.
And there are a ton of ways to get involved.
Yes, one of the simplest is right in your pocket. You can use an app on your phone like MyCoast or iNaturalist or Merlin Bird.
That helps scientists by gathering data about things like climate events, the distribution of invasive species, or the migration patterns of birds.
You can also get involved by taking part in one-off events like horseshoe crab tagging or butterfly counts.
Often you can find organizations like zoos and science centers looking for volunteers to accomplish longer projects.
Maybe a frog watch in the spring, or a community garden that'll encourage pollinators and grow food.
You can also find projects focused on local problems, like the one monitoring pollution around Tweed Airport.
And all of this can have some pretty important outcomes: a sense of involvement in your community, knowledge and confidence about how science works.
Feeling like you are building towards something important.
It might help you feel more involved in your community in maybe a way that you weren't before. You have something that you can take a little bit of ownership over, like, I helped with this. You're invested in more than just a day. You might be involved for a week, a month, or even longer if you decide, hey, I actually really like being involved in this.
Exploring these solutions might give us the best chance at survival
and help save vulnerable places where millions of people call home.
It's important that each community has its own voice and has its own way of sharing how they're being impacted, because they know best what's happening in their little microclimate.
And so if community members can help document some of these conditions, it's not just me going out and documenting some pictures and wondering what I should do with them. It's being compiled, it's being used in a way that is accessible to decision makers.
You're actually, believe it or not, more likely to heed information that comes from a friend or a trusted source than from even an authority figure.
And when you revive something, like when you layer future on history, it becomes present, and it's the most beautiful thing.
Higher Ground is produced and mixed by Sabrina Garone and me, J.D. Allen, with editing from Harriet Jones. Eve Zuckoff, Molly Ingram, Ada Uzenlar, Megan Briggs, Davis Donovan, and Claire Galick did fact-checking and research. Graphic art by Joshua Joseph. Music is composed by Samuel Davies. Higher Ground is a production of WSHU Public Radio. These stories are available wherever you get your podcasts, and we've got even more stories about responding to climate impacts with the WSHU series Sound Science that was featured in this show. If your community is adapting to a changing environment, send us an email at podcasters@wshu.org. Thank you for taking this journey with us.
Higher Ground is distributed by APM American Public Media.